then one of the fundamental components of almost all control systems is your safety instrumented systems or your SIS. This is going to go in and perform fail-safe analysis. So if something is occurring that can get to a dangerous or unsafe level, your safety instrumented system is going to step in, control, minimize, or contain the damage that can occur in that environment. So this almost has an overriding feature that literally if something bad is trying to happen in that control system, your SIS will step in and stop it. It has overriding authority to be able to take control and provide fault tolerance capabilities to minimize any disastrous effects within your environment. Now, pause for a second. Put on your security hat. If you're an attacker and you want to go in and you want to gain control that overrides any other security measures that are in place, what would be a good system to go after? Because guess what? This can override any other control. This can bypass any other measure because it was built to do that from a safety perspective. So I always find it ironic that when we go in and we do security assessments for our clients and we always look at what are the most dangerous processes and what are the most critical areas that you need to protect, this is never on the list. And I always raise my hand going, well, why isn't your SIS on here as one of the most dangerous apps? Oh, no, Eric. The SIS isn't for dangerous. It's for safety. It does a great job. I said, but can it override, bypass, or get around any other control mechanism? Doesn't it pretty much have Trump authority over anything else? And they're like, yes. I said, so if that system ever gets compromised by an attacker and they can alter, modify, or change the values, can't they inadvertently use your safety system to actually cause unsafe things to occur? Once again, back to the gentleman's comment of technical level integrity. How are you verifying the integrity of the controls that are in place from a fault tolerance for your safety instrument and system? Because if those parameters can be put to an unsafe level, I can actually turn your safety system into an exposure that can cause significant harm. So we always have to think like the adversary, and even though systems might have initially been designed for safety, because of the power and capability we've given it to override any other process controls, we need to make sure that that system is really locked down, validated, protected, and monitored very, very closely. Then we get into BMS, which are building management systems. These are the systems that pretty much control the environmental functioning of a large building or hotel. So when you walk around this hotel, there are many components of the building management system that are making sure there's proper lighting, proper power, fire, security, equipment. Those of you that were here, I think it was Monday afternoon, was that when they did the safety check at the hotel? I believe it was Monday, late morning, early afternoon. They went in and said, we are conducting a safety check where there was a simulated hazardous material outside the building. That was impacting the BMS, because what did they say to do? If this was a real emergency, you need to turn off lighting because we're going to turn off the ventilation, because if there's poisonous gases, the ventilation could spread it quicker. But by dropping off the ventilation to minimize the spreading of the dangerous gases, what's going to happen? Temperature is going to rise. These generate temperature. So they said turn off all the electrical to minimize unnecessary heat to impact the fact that we're not going to have cooling set up during this interval. So that's all the BMS components that interplay of the functioning, the running, and the control of a building. And once again, if we always think from an attacker perspective, we often don't think of this as a target. Why would somebody want to go after that or cause harm? Once again, if I had ill intentions or want to do terrorist-level activity, and I want to release poisonous gases within a large hotel to cause large-scale impact and safety concerns, what better way to do that than to guarantee that the ventilation system is turned on? Because what better way to get the gases to every single room very, very quickly? So if I know that the hotel's going to try to shut it off and I can hijack, compromise, or hack in to the building management system, I can then once again use it as a transport mechanism for the dangerous gases that I'm potentially going to want to launch. So a lot of times we sort of write off systems. Oh, this couldn't ever be a target. But when we start putting on our evil hat, unfortunately, there's many ways it can be manipulated for harmful actions within a situation. Then, as we've sort of alluded to, and now we'll talk about, one of the most fundamental components of all industrial control systems are PLCs, programmable logic controllers. They are essentially, at the most fundamental level, a PLC is typically a specialized computer that's meant to receive information from multiple inputs, get details from the control unit, and then pass it back to those multiple systems. So if you typically look at the breakdown of this, you have your PLC, which typically has remote access via modems or wireless. It's then going to go in and provide information to the human-machine interface. This is typically your console that your operators are going to be working out to receive alerts, monitoring or other actions. So the PLC is going to provide data to the human machine interface. The operator is then going to decide to open, close, or make adjustments to motors, valves, or whatever components based on the industry we're in. It's going to send that information back to the PLC, and then the PLC is going to go in and make appropriate action on the different sensors or areas. And then the other critical piece that we're going to talk about later is we always want to keep a detailed logging of what's happening and what's occurring within our environment so we can better make adjustments, look at historical perspective, and look for trends or analysis. And all those details about all the actions, activity, and components that are being done by the PLC is ultimately stored in your data historian. So if we're using sort of IT terms, your data historian is sort of the logging component that's storing that information of what the PLC is doing. So if there's ever an issue or a problem, you now have the historical perspective to understand and look for information. Once again, this is typically done for optimization and safety purposes. So you can look at ways to optimize the operation based on historical data. And if there is a problem issue, you can use that from a safety perspective to understand why it occurred. It's also awesome from a security perspective. Because in order to get advanced attacks today, signature detection doesn't scale. The idea of signature detection, where we're going to look for a pattern of evil and find it within our logs, doesn't work because today's attack vectors are always changing, modifying, or different. However, they always alter normal activity. So one of the things we always do from an incident response perspective is we're going to go in and I'm going to start pulling normal activity and looking for value ranges within that data historian to understand what's the normal operating capability of my PLCs. And then I'm going to look for any anomalies. I'm going to look for any strange occurrences, because the bottom line is, if somebody's going to try or successfully break into your environment and do harmful action, what do they have to do? Do something different than what you're normal doing. Because if somebody's going to break in and what they do is the exact same activity that your PLC always does, I would say, then what's the problem? If they're not doing anything different, unusual, or strange, and they're doing what your system always does, then that's just normal activity. They're not harmful. In order for somebody to switch from normal to harmful, they got to deviate or alter their behavior. And the historian is a great area to see and monitor and track those deviation points within our environment. So now that we understand some of the components, we now have to get into the roles and responsibilities of people who are working within the environment. Remember, the goal of control systems is to minimize, not completely replace humans. We are not running a total 100% automated facility. We want to reduce, but there still has to be humans in play. And the problem is, if I have an environment that's secure for the last 30 days, what is one of the number one reasons why a secure environment would become non-secure and or compromised? Changes. Who makes changes? Humans. So that becomes a target vector. Now, I always want to be careful here, because a lot of times in security, if we're not putting things in perspective, we can get in to this activity of, oh, the humans are evil and bad. Blah, blah. Wait, wait, wait. Humans, yes. On the one hand, they are often a cause of adverse behavior and exposures and problems from security. But we can't forget that you can't run a company without humans. So they're our greatest asset. So we need to make sure that we allow that greatest asset to be able to function and perform the activities that it needs in a way to control and minimize any adverse activity within our environment. Humans provide a lot of good, even though they inadvertently can represent security risks. So we have to provide that balance and can't lose sight of the positive impact that they provide. Now, if we look at the roles and responsibilities of humans, you often have several levels. You have the process engineer. They're the ones that design out the solution. So your process engineers are the ones that are going to design out the general layout functionality. They are good to initially sit down with because they're the ones who are going to integrate security into the design. So if you want to alter, modify, or change the general structure of your design, it's going to be the process engineers that are going to have to approve, make sure they understand and know why this is important from a security perspective. So all design decisions are typically at the process engineer. Your field technicians are the ones that are directly working with and altering typically your RTUs, your remote terminal units, and they're doing maintenance, updates, upgrades, and other functions. So it's important that you train those field technicians on understanding security implications and what is or is not acceptable behavior. Remember, a lot of these field technicians are not security folks. What is the primary goal of a field technician? Fix something that's broken. So they go in and they typically usually have checklists and they'll start swapping moving parts and they'll maybe even move wires in order to get something working. And when something's working that wasn't working, check and move on. So we need to make sure that we have security within their checklist and integrate it into their processes to make sure that while they get something working, they don't inadvertently turn off the security, because in many control systems, we go in and we don't count security in the functional tests. So if the basic functionality is working and security fails, it would still pass the test. I would argue that's a bad test. You need to make sure that the tests that your field technicians are going to run after they fix an environment has security as part of the functional test. So if security is not working, the test fails. And if security is working, the test passes. That's a mindset shift, that a lot of organizations are not doing today. Security is not integrated into the test plans of the field technicians, which is one of the primary reasons why security fails and we don't catch it. So one of the big areas we want to focus in on is, of course, each of these areas, but relook at all your acceptance testing that your field technicians perform and go and ask yourself how much of that checks that security is properly running in that environment. And I'll tell you, I've looked at a lot of the field technician checklist and it's a low number. Very few of them are focused on the security aspect that's needed or required in order to work correctly. And like I said, I spend a lot of time on the nuclear side. One of the things that we're putting a lot of energy and effort on now is training the inspectors on security. Because most of the inspectors that go to nuclear utilities have been doing their job for 15 years, and it's basically focused on the physical human safety component of it. So if you go in and you now have to have them check security, they have to be able to understand that. Well, one of the things I learned very quickly, field technicians are very big on reproducible results. Well, how do you get reproducible results? You always do standard checklists of how you function and perform activities. So what I quickly realized is I can sit there and I can put these field technicians or inspectors in all the security classes that I want. I can go in and have them read all the security books that I want. I can put them in all the awareness sessions that I want, but if I don't change their checklist, it ain't going to happen. So you got to integrate down and understand how they operate. And field technicians are all about checklists and acceptance testing. So security has to be integrated at that level. Anything else is futile at best and is not going to be effective at getting the measures that we need. So work at each one of those respective levels. The question is, what type of checklist would be put in for the field technician for that to work? Once again, it depends on the type of device, but let's look at a few examples. So if you're going in and you're looking at RTUs, remote terminal units, we would go in and make sure that after they did any upgrades or testing, we would go in and have them verify which services are running on that system and make sure that no extraneous services are turned on. We would make sure that any authentication that went in to verify and validate back to the primary control unit was working and functioning correctly within that environment. We would make sure that, let's say it's a wireless control unit, we would have a series of tests, or we would give them tools that they would run to make sure that only authorized devices can actually be able to run and connect to that wireless unit. So we would go in and look at what equipment they're repairing and what are the minimal security requirements that are needed and create the checklist against it. So authentication could be one, services could be another, making sure that they didn't remove or take out any unnecessary security devices, firewalls, if there's a filtering device, make sure that's still in place. The trick with a lot of this is to write tools that they can run. Because a lot of times the way they do testing is they're going to run a tool and it's going to come back with a pass or fail state. So if you can go in and simplify port scanning, simplify controls where you're not giving them a full NMAP, but you're giving them a limited NMAP that has set ports that come back and either say failed or success if it matches your required port list, that's how you start winning there, is try to make these tools as simple as possible, binary level feedback, good or bad, yes or no, pass or fail. Then we look at the programmers. They're the ones that are typically writing a lot of the code, doing a lot of the customization. In a lot of cases, depending on the environment, these often are the vendor. Because in a lot of cases, a lot of the code and a lot of the functionality will often be written by your vendors. Now, the good news is vendors are fully aware of the security issues and challenges that are out there. But you need to go in and continually work with them on what are the security requirements that you want to achieve. The big area, whether it's your own programmers or whether it's a vendor, that I urge you to focus in is error checking of input values. If you look at most of the problems that we run across with code in control system environments, it's not proper error checking of input values. And the good news is many vendors are doing an awesome job with that. Problem, you might be running 6 or 7 versions outdated of that software. We had one client where they had a major incident where their entire system was compromised and taken over. And I'm looking at the equipment and I'm puzzled. And they're like, why are you puzzled, Eric? I'm like, because the vendor fixed that issue 3 years ago. Problem, this particular utility was running code that was 8 years old. And the interesting thing about it was, if they downloaded or installed the latest code, it had no negative impact to the functional requirements, but it greatly increased their security. So once again, another theme you're going to hear this week is communicate and work closely with those vendors. In many cases, the vendors are farther ahead in security than the utility companies, but if you're not communicating with them, you might not be taking advantage of those benefits there. But input control and error checking, verifying size and character set of all inputs, is one of the biggest areas you can get a great return from a security perspective. And then the operators are the ones that are monitoring, watching, and typically working in the operations center, working on the control units to adjust, modify, or make changes. The biggest area that we see with operators from a security perspective is plugging in or bringing in external software, USB and DVDs. Huge, huge problem there. And the thing that I always sort of chuckle at is I don't know why people are so negative against USB, but DVDs are perfectly okay. We have clients that have all of these policies. No USBs. You can't plug in USB devices. You can't bring in USB hard drives. But oh, DVDs are perfectly okay. For a second. They both can have malware. They both can be infected. They both can have an exposure point. Now, yes, I understand that USB allows more devices to connect and other components there, but you shouldn't be focusing on just USB. Why? Because what happens when new technology comes down the road? Your policy should be written on you cannot bring in any software from the outside into an operational environment without proper validation done. And whether it's DVDs, USBs, or any other devices, they all come into the same issue. So in the last 6 months, we've seen a lot of our clients have all this policy and control on the USB front, very little on the DVDs, and DVDs are causing lots of problems and lots of issues. They can have malware. They can have backdoors. They can cause lots of challenges there. So any external media we have to control and monitor, and that's the exposure from the operator perspective. Then we start getting in to the other participants that come into play. You have your vendors, which in many cases, they are one of your best resources from a security perspective because they're the ones that ultimately can control, update, or make changes to your devices. And you need their partnership because I'll tell you right now, if you go to any executive in your company and you tell them that you want to alter, modify, or change anything in your environment, what's the first question? Is this approved by the vendor? So the more you can work and build up that relationship, the better. You also have integrators, consultants that involve help with the design, help with the overall security. Then you have the owners of the system. And more countries, the government is starting to do more and more regulations of controlling and managing utility-based companies. And therefore, most control systems are going to have some government regulation and oversight in place. And the big area here is international, because we're seeing a lot more, not only utilities are international based, but in a lot of cases, the vendors are international based. Most of the control systems that we use in the United States are not manufactured in the United States. They're not purchased from U.S. companies. So now all of a sudden when you're bringing in, you have import-export laws associated with it. So I just wanted to be clear when I'm talking about government, I'm not just talking about regulations like NRC and nuclear. I'm talking about import-export, State Department, crypto verification. All those factors quickly come into play when you're doing cross-international boundaries within the control system space. Bottom line is everyone shares responsibility in making sure those systems are secure. If you are the vendor, you can't go in and say, "Up, it's up to our client to make sure they're secured correctly." And if you're the client, you can't assume that the vendor is going to do all the work. Coordination and communication need to work very closely where the requirements are clearly communicated back and forth. And as I alluded to and mentioned earlier, many vendors have integration services, and in many cases, they're much lower cost because remember, if you have an incident, you look bad, but the vendor looks bad. Example, Stuxnet. What vendor was involved? I'm not picking on him, but it was all over the news. It was all over the news, right? Siemens there. So once again, while they necessarily weren't fully involved with that, the vendor is as exposed as the company is if there's a breach. So both need to work very, very closely together. So then when we go in and we start looking at the problem set, this is where the complexity starts getting in. In many cases, you have very, very complex requirements that are in play. And in most environments, functionality drives the requirement setting, not security. You also have very complex systems where you can have hundreds of thousands of control loops that are going back and forth on a regular basis. And then you have all these different components that are at play within our environment. And then when you start going in and start doing interoperability testing, trying to change or modify any of those devices are really, really difficult. One of the best pieces of advice I can give with security is you need to be actively involved in your system acceptance testing. Before anything ever goes in production, you need to put most of your energy there. Because what I'll tell you is in most control systems, once something makes it into production, you're talking 15, 18 years before you can change it. So if you want to have an immediate measurable difference in your environment, you need to get engaged before those systems go live. You need to get engaged before those systems ever go into production, because if you're waiting to do testing after production occurs, too little, too late. Any of you who attended my talk yesterday, one of the things we talked about is you very rarely do hard-scale technical pen testing in a production environment. Why? It's way too dangerous. You're going to go in and do what we talk about tomorrow, where you build out your attack surface, you do your traceability, but most pen testing in production are 100% manual paper-based exercises because it's absolutely too risky in a real-life production environment. However, where do you do crazy pen testing where you start firing packets at the devices? In the test environment, in the dev environment, before you go in and do the final acceptance testing, that's when you're going to beat on these systems. So the more you can engage on the acceptance testing and get security to have key criteria as control gates before it goes into production, that's how you're going to start winning this game. Because if you're playing in the production space, you got an 18-year life cycle that you're messing around with, and that's just going to be too little, too late. Also, who owns the control systems in your environment? This is another big difference. When I go to many of our traditional clients, financial, healthcare, and others, and I do security, who am I mainly working with? The CIO. The chief information officer controls most of the servers and assets in a traditional IT environment. In control systems, who am I dealing with? Typically the operational officer. Completely different mindset in terms of the goals and functions that are at play there. So you need to understand who the owners are and work closely with them to make sure that you're understanding the requirements and having proper security integrated in at all levels in those environments. Then from a government perspective, they're often going to regulate information. They're going to provide guidance. They're going to set standards. And you need to make sure that you're adherent with those, because one of the things we're noticing is a lot of these governments are actually adding in pretty stiff penalties if you're not compliant, both financial or operational. One of the things we're seeing a lot, especially in the nuclear, is going in and building a nuclear power plant. You're talking a lot of money and a lot of time frame. Well, what a lot of these governments are doing is if you don't engage and have the proper validation, they'll wait for you to spend $40 million and 12 years, and they'll never give you operational licenses to actually run that thing. And this isn't science fiction. I can give you several examples where organizations have spent considerable amount of money and the system never went live. Being from the East Coast of the United States and growing up on Long Island, one of the best use cases of that is Lilco, the Long Island Lighting Company. They decided out on the island to build Shoreham Nuclear Power Plant. Now, they were convinced that they would be able to convince government regulators to allow operation. Well, the government regulators kept saying to them, "Where's your evacuation plan?" Long Island. It's an island. Means it's surrounded by water, which means there's only really one way on and one way off the system. Well, they kept ignoring the regulators, going, "Oh, no, that's not a problem. That's not a problem. That's not a problem." And they ended up spending over $80 million on building this. And literally it got disassembled before it ever went into production because they didn't follow the proper regulations, and they kept spending money And the government regulators kept folding their arms saying, unless you can show us a safe evacuation plan, you better stop, you better stop. And they just kept ignoring. And they finally got to the final point where they called their bluff. And the government regulators said, yeah, that's not happening. And pretty much it was a total waste of money because it never went into operations. And you can research that and see all the details on it. So this kind of stuff is real issues that we have to be aware of if we're going to play in this space. Now, when we look at the types of processes that we're dealing with, there's typically three main: discrete, batch, continuous, and of course, hybrid is a little bit of all of these. So what I want you to do is, as we go through this next section, think about your environment and say, okay, what type of processing do you have in place? Because each type of processing has different security issues that come into play. Discrete processing is where each component in the processing or each machine performs a specific task, and there's little interaction between each of the different devices. A great example of a discrete process is automotive manufacturing. If you've ever visited or gone in and seen how an automobile is manufactured, each machine has its own separate functioning. So you're going to have one machine that's going to go in and put the door. You're going to have another machine that's going to go in and assemble the hood. You're going to have another machine that's going to deal with installing the wheel. And each machine has an independent focus that's performed in a sequential pattern along the path. Then we have batch processing, which is typically where you have one system that's combining many different components and many different chemicals together in order to produce the desired outcome. So if you're making adhesives, if you're making chemicals, soda, I do a lot of work in industrial control systems, and one of my clients is a very large soda manufacturer. And whenever we go in and I tell people, they're like, why in the world are you going in and doing ICS work for a large soda manufacturer? Who said control systems was only utilities, oil, and gas, right? For some reason, we go in and think it's just that. In the class we taught, we actually had a large manufacturer attend, send five people, because that's control systems. So we got to remember that when we're talking control systems, anytime you have sensors, coordination, activity, it's going to come into play. So large soda manufacturers, shipping companies, large production organizations, automobile manufacturers, all are in the ICS land. It's not just the oil, gas, and nuclear that we sort of traditionally associate with it. So if we're making soda, adhesives, or chemicals, we're going to be doing a batch processing. Batch processing is typically associated relative to continuous with lower volume output. So you're going to go in and you're going to produce a certain amount of orange soda for the next 2 days. And then after you do that, you're going to stop and you're going to produce a certain amount of grape soda. And then you're going to stop and you're going to produce a certain amount of diet soda. So typically with the batch processing, you're going in and doing a discrete operation for a period of time, producing somewhat low volume, stopping and then moving on to another process. That's compared with your continuous, where you're constantly producing the same amount of components. So if you're going in and you're producing chlorine components, gases, or other factors, you're going to constantly be producing that. So your continuous processes is usually high volume, where you're nonstop producing the same output over and over and over again. And then your hybrid is typically where you're going in and doing a little bit of discrete with a little bit of continuous type operations in terms of how you're doing that. So for example, if I'm going in and I'm constantly producing soda, yes, the actual making of the soda is going to be that continuous or batch process. However, once I make this soda, what do I need to do? I need to put it in a bottle. So that's going to now become the batch piece, where the soda is now going to feed to the bottle. And once I put soda in a bottle, what do I need to do? Put a top on the bottle. Then once I have the bottle, what do I need to do? Put the bottle in a six-pack, and then the six-pack in a box, and a box down the road. So now you can see that while the creation of the actual component, the soda, the glue, or the adhesives, is going to be that batch or continuous, it needs to be part of a discrete process where then you put it into components to be able to ship it, to be able to be consumed by the end entity that's going to purchase and buy that device. So we often see a lot of this hybrid processes on real control systems, because once you make the chemical with either batch or continuous, you need to have a discrete process for manufacturing it in a way that it can be sold to the ultimate consumer. So if we take a look at our components and operation of our control systems, you're typically, let's start in the upper left-hand side. You have to have humans monitoring, watching, and having the ability to make updates or changes to the processing capability. So that's going to be your HMI, your human machine interface. This is typically your monitoring stations where you're going to look for alerts, unusual activities, unusual entities that are there. And that's going to feed directly into the controllers to be able to make changes or alterations. Then, of course, you can also have remote diagnostics and maintenance done by your field technicians and or your vendors that are also going to be able to make changes to the controllers. The controllers are then going to go in and control the actual working of the components, the actual motor and other measures that are going to be part of the overall control process. This control process is going to be taking inputs and outputs. This is the manufacturing line. This is the production of the electricity, the chemicals, or the shipping of the items. And then they're going to produce output to sensors, which are going to go back to remote diagnostics and the HMI, so this way it can be monitored to make adjustments, changes, or processes. So this bottom line here is the actual production, and this upper area is the monitoring to make sure that it's being done in a proper, safe manner. And we tried to keep this chart relatively simple, but what would be a big block that would go across this? The safety control. So the safety control is going to be monitoring, which is an automated way to control and stop from a fault perspective anything severe from happening within a certain environment. So as we start putting this all together, let's start building out some of these reference architectures that we're going to be using in play. Now, one of the big areas we need to talk about, which I know is always sort of a fun area in this space, you can't protect what you don't know. So I'm just going to get it out there, because it's going to be something that we're going to have to be dancing around all week, so I don't want to dance around, so let's just throw it out there. You got to have some accurate representation of your network and environment in order to have some level of security. I'll be even more blunt. If you don't have an accurate, up-to-date network diagram, how can you make any claims about your security, your protection, and your controls? Because I would argue that if you don't have some accurate representation of your network and an environment, how can you protect what you don't know? Oh, but Eric, we have firewalls. Great. How do you know the firewall is plugged into the right spot if you don't know where your devices are? How do you know you're monitoring in the right location if you don't know where any of your devices are? So the bottom line is, if you do not have an accurate representation of your environment, that is the number one assignment you need to do before anything else. Because anything else you try doing is going to be futile at best, because firewalls can't help you if you don't know where your devices are located. Monitoring can't help you if you don't know what's plugged into your environment. And I'll just drive this point home even further. Most of the incidents that we have worked on in control systems is usually occurring because there were unauthorized devices that were misconfigured, that was plugged into the network that nobody knew about. That's usually either the primary or secondary cause of most incidents, is organizations not knowing what's in their environment. So you need to be able to have asset management and configuration control with change control are the three pieces that are needed for success. And in order to do that, you must have an accurate diagram in place. So to me, the three critical things required to be successful in security in control systems is you have to have asset management, You have to know what's plugged in. Configuration management, you need to know how they're configured and set up, and you need to manage and control change. Change control. All changes must go through our change control process. So if we want to go in and be successful here, three things at a minimum you have to have in place is asset management, configuration management, and change control. And I would argue that you can't do those three things if you don't have an accurate representation of your environment. So excellent question. So the question is, when we say an accurate representation, are we looking for a logical or a physical representation of your environment? Ideally, I would like both. Ideally, I would like both, but I understand that you can't always have ideal. At a minimum, what we want to focus in is what we call data flows. We want to understand information flows of what information can flow from what areas to what areas, because that's going to represent the exposure. So at a minimum, if you have a logical data flow diagram that you can accurately validate, I will take that. Now, ideally, I would like the physical, because that's going to ultimately drive where we put our security devices in place. But from an exposure perspective, if you at least have a data flow, a logical representation of where information can flow in and out, that will at least be enough for us to be able to identify the attack surfaces and the exposure factors. But I'll help you out. The logical data flow is what I need to do all the analysis and when I need to go in and find where your exposure points are. But then once you say fix it, I'm eventually going to need the physical to be able to fix it. Because if I just have a logical flow between segment A to segment B, and I say, okay, I need to throw a data diode in here to allow sensor information to go out but no data to come back in, that's great. But unless I have a physical representation, I won't know exactly where to place it at the switch hub device level within your environment. But here's the trick. Typically, the physical diagram doesn't need to be done at a component level. It needs to be done at a subnet or network level. So if you look at what I have here, I don't have every single device in the environment represented on this particular chart. But what do I have? I have all my serial connections down here. I have my field devices here. I have my proprietary control network here. I have my corporate network here. And then I have my outside DMZ network. That is good enough from a physical perspective. I don't need every single device. I just need to know the physical control point. So if I want to go in and start replacing a firewall with a data diode or put an IDS, I need to know where the connectivity is. So when we're talking about the data flows, the logical and the physical, it needs to be done at a high enough level so we can see where exposures and placements are. But you don't have to have every single actual device out there. You just need to know where the general zones are in order for it to work. So while it is going to take a little work, it's not typically as complex as people realize, because I want to know where the zones of coverage are. I don't have to know specifically every name of every device. So if we look at a few referenced architectures, here's a typical DCS environment. This is going to be your traditional corporate environment. You have your internet. Then from your internet, you're going to have your VPN connectivity and firewalls. You're going to have separation points. This is where your engineering, accounting, basically the business functions that are needed to run your company are located there. Then we're typically going to have multiple levels of firewalls. And now we're going to get in to our control unit environment. This is where you have the human-machine interfaces, your critical servers, the control unit, your operations center is typically located here. Then you're going to go in and have connectivity to the local devices within the facility, and any field devices are going to all correlate to that location that are going to be managed by your control network that's ultimately going to be connected for analysis to your business environment. Now, the goal here is to put more levels of separation. The general strategy of security is the more levels of separation that we can put in place, the better. So ideally, if we drew out this logical diagram, we would want something that looks like this. Internet, totally untrusted. This is fully trusted. And then when we go from here to here, we're increasing our trust level. And the whole idea was this, I'm not saying that you'll never get compromised. You absolutely can get compromised, but the goal is that if somebody can break into this, we will catch them, detect, before they get to our most trusted assets in the environment. That's the general design strategy that we're trying to set up as we go through these reference architectures, is create enough level of separation to allow communication to go back and forth between them, but having enough levels that even if somebody does break in, we will be able to detect and minimize damage before they get to the most trusted entity. And the reason we've done that is, what is the best, most secure way of deploying it? What we used to do 15 years ago, full air gap. That's the best security. Now, yes, you still have the human component, but at least if it's fully air gapped, you don't have any connectivity there. So here's the problem. When we have an air gap network, that's going to be our air gap network. We have the business unit that's fairly low trust connected to the internet. If exposure happens, not a big deal. We have our fully trusted control system network that's secure. This is the mistake that a lot of clients do. They just do that connectivity between them. Not going to work. If you're going to go in and add connectivity, you have to go in and add in those separation levels. Those are firewall, firewall, firewall between it to create that separation point. So just remember that when you're taking your existing connected network to the internet and you're taking your high trust and you're removing the air gap, you got to add layers or zones to be able to control filter, so we can add in that detection line so you can actually detect and find the adversary before they get in. That's the general goal that we're trying to achieve. And you'll see as we add this all together, that's how we create that 5-level zone of trust that I'll show you in a few slides of how this all plays in. But I want to give you the theory, because what I found is if I just give you the solution and you don't understand why it was designed that way, you might remove segments of it and decrease your security. So I wanted you to understand the logic of why we've created it in the way that we've done. Excellent question. So the question is, if we go back and look at our zones, and let's just pop up. I'll come back to these slides. But this is, I think, what they were probably referencing yesterday, where the safety zone is the most important one. And then you sort of work your way up. If we start putting in one-way connections, data diodes, isn't that going to impact functionality and limit the information flow? Absolutely. But remember, it's all the perspective of how you look at it. If you go in and look at it as, here's what we have, then yes, you're limiting functionality. But if you look at it at, we're going from an air-gapped environment. Air-gapped environment has no communication. It has zero way. So now if I go to an air gap to a one-way, I'm actually increasing functionality. So if you put it in the perspective of where we were, and I'm not giving you the option of two-way. That's way too dangerous. So I'm giving you the option of zero or one way, which do you want? One way is better than zero. So if you look at where we were and where we're going, the one way actually is increasing functionality, not decreasing it. Now, I like where you're going, because the problem we always have with security is if you go in and give somebody a little bit, they're going to want more. They're going to want more. They're going to want more. I always play this game. I have 3 wonderful children. And I'm sort of a binary person, and my kids will go, oh, I want a cookie before we go to bed. And I'm like, no cookies. Oh, come on, Dad. Can't we just have one cookie? No cookie. Well, when my parents, their grandparents come to visit, I am convinced that the role of a grandparent is to torture your child for everything you did to them when you were growing up. Because my parents, my kids' grandparents, they'll go in, oh, come on, give them one cookie. And I'll look at grandma and say, watch. So we give them one cookie. Once we give them the one cookie, are they satisfied? No, what do they want now? 2 cookies. And then, okay, no, you had one cookie going to bed. Oh, come on, give them. So you give them two cookies. Are they satisfied? No, they want three cookies. So the problem you got to be careful of is as soon as you go and give your users one cookie, they're not going to look at the fact that you gave them one cookie. They're going to look at the fact that they don't have two cookies. And what I'm alluding to is if you take an air-gapped environment and you say, okay, we'll give you a one-way link, which is better than what you had, they'll be happy for 2 months. But in 2 months, what do they want? Two-way. And then trust me, if they could figure out a way to do it, they'd want three-way, four-way, five-way, six-way, right? So they always want more and more. So you just got to be careful of, yes, the one-way is an improvement over the air gap, but it does have limited functionality. But remember, there is a level where you do have to balance functionality and security. You do have to make that risk case, and we talk about that later in the week, where you actually build a risk profile of what is or is not the acceptable level of risk, which will ultimately drive those decisions. Right, so normally what we're going to do here is I'm going to go in and put inline devices. So our first rule is prevention is ideal. So I'm going to go in, and that's our ultimate goal. So I'm going to go, and I'm going to put all those preventive devices in place. We'll cover this more on Saturday, but preventive devices must have a zero false positive, so they can't block everything. What we're actually going to be doing is we're going to be pulling the logs from all those areas and looking for anomalies, monitoring, and looking for indications of compromise to be able to set off an alert before we get in there. In traditional IT environments, that is done with an IDS, an intrusion detection system. In control systems, your IDS becomes a sensor and you actually utilize SIM solutions, security incident event management, where now you're pulling the logs from the firewalls, from the servers, from the HMIs, from the field units, and now your IDS is just one of many sensors that feed into your SIM solution to correlate and look for those anomalies of compromise within your environment. So what we're really talking about on the detection side is the correlation of all those logs from different components, which goes way beyond IDSs in traditional IT environments. And as we get into day 4, we will cover that in more detail.